welcome to Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies. Thanks for joining us once again. My name is Kurt Holman. I'm a staff writer for Creative Loafing Newspaper in Atlanta. And with me again are my co-hosts, as always.
I'm Matt Goldberg. I'm the managing editor for Collider.com.
And I'm Russ Fisher. I'm an editor at SlashFilm.com.
And today we're going to talk about mostly about two films that are new this week, one of which I believe we'd like more than the other one. And the films are Toy Story 3 and Jonah Hex. And who wants to kick us off with Toy Story 3?
I'll let Matt do that. Mm.
All right. Toy Story 3, basically, the end of Toy Story 2 is Andy will grow up and go to college and, you know, we'll be there for him. And Toy Story 3 is Andy's grown up and he's going to college. Yeah. And so now the toys he has remaining that have been in a toy box and have been played with for years, mm-hmm. and now they're sort of like, are we going to the attic? And is anyone going to go with Andy to college? And so the other toys think a better option than being in the attic. They think Andy doesn't want them, mm-hmm. so they're going to be like, let's be donated to this daycare center. Mm-hmm. Woody finds out that it was an accident. They were supposed to go in the attic and be together. And so it's basically Woody wants to rescue them from Sunnyside. They think Sunnyside's a great place, but it turns out that
there's a dark side.
There's a dark side. They're basically they get fooled into thinking that they're going to be with all the older kids, like not the older kids, but I would guess maybe
more age appropriate.
More age appropriate. And then they go in with the toddlers and. Yeah.
It's almost like the Omaha Beach scene in Saving Private Ryan when, you know, they're all excited about being played with and they come in and they're torn apart and used as hammers and hammered and, mm-hmm. and stuff like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah. And so then they want to bust out of there. It becomes mm-hmm. a prison break movie. And it's basically, I don't want to say the same plot as the first two, but mm-hmm. Pixar has gone to this escape rescue plot numerous times in their filmography. Toy Story has it. Toy Story 2 has it. Wall-E has it to an extent. Incredibles has it to an extent. Mm-hmm. Up has it to an extent. Mm-hmm. That is the plot of Finding Nemo. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying those movies are all the same, but it's a kind of narrative structure yeah. they like to go to.
I think it feels like that a little bit more with Toy Story 3, just because there's this big scene at the end involving like a garbage truck and a dump and kind of compactors and things like that.
It's very extended. It feels like this whole escape kind of gets a little long-winded.
Yeah.
And it gets a little extreme as well. It sort of is taken to it's the end game of the chase is visualized in a way that seems maybe a little bit overblown
for the
story as a whole.
Yeah, there are characters facing like what could be death in a way that's, you know,
it gets very dark.
Very serious. And yeah, and it's very serious in a way that, like, even live action films, you don't see characters facing something like this and dealing with it and however they deal with it. And not a humorous way, I should say.
Because right.
usually it's like, oh, we've got this problem. It's like, we better get out of here, you know. And this time it's like, they're prepared for the worst. And it can really hit you, you know.
Right.
So, yeah. one thing, just sort of going in, how do we think this holds up compared to the other two, which, you know, everyone pretty much loves the other two. I wouldn't assume that you guys do, but
I do. I don't think it's as good as the first two. Mm-hmm. I think its biggest problem is the pacing. The first two have a very nice flow in terms of, you know, good running action scenes, but then they take a moment to breathe. And I never really felt that with Toy Story 3. Mm-hmm. Toy Story 3 definitely gets emotional, especially at the end. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's a breathless film. And it's action-packed, and it's fun, and it's funny. And there's nothing wrong with that. But to me, it's almost too much. I wanted to take a breath. I wanted these characters to sort of take a moment, and I never really felt they got a lot of the moments, the quiet, introspective moments that we saw characters had in Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2.
Well, those character points have pretty much all been covered, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. it's like, so, okay, where do we go with these characters? It's not like there's that much new to learn about them. Mm-hmm. You know, they're dynamic, you know, they're believable and they're well drawn, but at the same time, they're pretty straightforward, simple, you know, mm-hmm. kids movie characters / action movie characters. And there's not that much, I mean, in this context, it seems like there's not that much more that we can mine out of them. So as a result, yeah, exactly. But it's not like there's crazy depth, or they're not, you know, their interactions with one another are pretty set. It's not like we suddenly jump into Toy Story 3 and it's years later and like the dynamics of the group have changed. Like it's, they're toys. There's, you know, the whole thing with, with, you know, Woody, the Tom Hanks voice character, is that he's always the same. He's always going to be there for you. He's never going to give up. And consequently, he's always the same. You know, well, so it's not like there's no new wrinkles to the way these characters are interacting with each other. So the movie kind of becomes, all right, now we're going to put them in a bigger, crazier scenario and watch them get out of it. But that was kind of all that I really saw in the movie.
There's a little bit of, I guess, more desperation that they've ratcheted up for the characters, because they, you know, have been basically left in a toy box for probably the better part of a decade, and some of like the regular toys who've been from the previous movies they allude to have like been gone in like yard sales or stuff like that. So it's almost like they're dead or something, even though it's not really that dark, you know. But it's like this sort of nine core group of toys are like all the toys that are left, you know. And one thing that kind of this is a pretty minor point, but it kind of bugged me, is that, you know, the toys face different kind of fates, which is like, will one of them get to go to college with Andy? You know, it seems unlikely. Will they get thrown away? You know, face like a garbage can or whatever, or you know, the trash bag. You know, will they get a place like Sunnyside or get to play with other younger kids, or will they get sent to the attic? And there's a thing that's like, if they're Andy's toys, then they should go to the attic if he wants them to go to the attic. And it just seems like, well, that doesn't seem fair, you know? I mean, because they're like, it seems like them almost like Asimov's robots, you know? It's like, you need to do what your owner wants you to do, you know? And it seemed, it reminded me of this like weird little point in the movie Ratatouille, to jump back and make a complicated point, where there's this point in Ratatouille where they say that like rats can't steal food because it's like unethical. And it's like, and it kind of, some scenes kind of hinge on that, and it's like, well, it seems unfair to demand that rats can't steal. They're rats.
What they do.
That's, you know,
how it goes.
So,
yeah.
So that seemed to be like just a little thing that kind of bugged me in a film that otherwise I liked and enjoyed. I enjoyed more than I thought I would, and thought it had a lot more emotional complexity and things like that. Because the characters are pretty set.
Yeah.
But they introduced the kind of the warden of Sunnyside, who's this plush teddy bear called Hugzo, who's voiced by
Lotso.
Lotso. Right. Yeah. Thank you. I think I need to correct my review on that. You know.
Is that voiced by Ned Beatty?
Yes. And I was like, Ned Beatty's alive. That's awesome. You know. And they have a scene where it kind of shows like why Lotso has such a cruel streak in him, which you don't realize at first, and it's like a reprise of the When She Loved Me scene from Toy Story 2, which shows kind of the flashback to Jessie the cowgirl toy and how she was owned by a girl and then was abandoned, and how it has like this, I think Sarah McLachlan sings the song, and it's like one of the most heartbreaking scenes in the trilogy. Lotso had a similar experience, but it turned him real twisted and bitter. And it's like, if the first movie had kind of like, you know, the kind of the bad breakup, breaking your heart aspect, this has kind of the turning, getting angry and twisted about it. And that's there's some real complicated going on with that. And there's a lot about closure and letting go and moving on and realizing that you have to like let someone go for their own good in some circumstances, you know. So there's a lot of like stuff to chew on, which I was impressed with. You know?
Yeah, and it's a good movie. I don't want to be like, it's so dark and you know, the pacing. It's a fun movie. And first off, Ken is in the movie, voiced by Michael Keaton, who does an amazing job. Really funny character. You know, the banter, as we said, between the characters is spot on. And I think when people go to this movie, they will have a lot of fun. I would just say it's not as good as the first two, and it didn't capture me the way that Up and Wall-E have in the past couple years, but it's still a good movie. I don't want to sort of give the impression that I didn't like it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's Pixar. It's very well – I mean, the scripting is great. The dialogue moves really snappily. It's, as you've said, it's fun and funny. The performances are really good. The animation is breathtaking in places. I mean, there are a handful of different sequences where there's like this bit where Woody's trying to get out of Sunnyside, and he's kind of going through this complicated means to try to escape, and there's just these shots of him that are animated so incredibly well that I was marveling simply at that technical aspect of the movie. And yeah, I mean, in that respect, it's a good, like you said, it's a good movie. It's fun. It's fine. It's maybe not as, I don't think it's an exceptional movie by any stretch. And I don't think it's up with Pixar's best movies, but it's certainly well made, and it's entertaining, and it's better than most of what we've seen this summer by you know, with no small qualification there.
Yeah, I find it I mean, I agree that I didn't like it as much as the other two, but I feel like it's of a piece with the other two. So as a trilogy, it feels real consistent and on a real high level and not repetitive, you know. And one thing that struck me as funny is, like, they probably realized that, like, any family who has, like, kids and a VCR probably owns these movies and knows them real
inside
well.
Out,
so it can, like...
Especially families that have VCRs.
Well, you know, there may be some who don't, you know. I'm not, you know. So, so they're, like, inside jokes that you catch on to real quick. And, like, kind of the whole opening sequence is a reprise of, like, the Andy playing with his toy scenes from the first two movies, only done kind of like how Andy would imagine them and not just seeing him doing it with the toys. So it's like, you know, flat out, you know, 3D CGI, you know, is pushing the visual stuff to the limit. And it's just hilarious, and it's awesome.
It's very satisfying.
Although I will say, this is, like, up in terms of the 3D. It's not a movie where the 3D is sort of in your face, Toy Story coming at you. It's to add depth, and it looks, it cleans up the picture. It's one of those movies where if you see it in 3D or if you see it in 2D, it's still going to be just as good, but it's not a 3D movie where it's like, ugh, you did a bad job.
Yeah, no, the 3D looks good. I mean, and that opening sequence, I think, uses the 3D well, and some of the more subtle use of 3D that we've seen, I think, comes out in some of the other sort of Great Escape sequences, where, again, that whole just sense of depth is put to good use. There are a couple of really clever little bits there as they're trying to, you know, as the group of toys is really trying to bust their way out of Sunnyside. And that stuff works really well. And as somebody who's completely disinterested in 3D, I wasn't distracted by it. And that's a big step. And in places I you know, found myself appreciating it. So if you've been resistant to 3D or found it to be kind of irritating or wasteful, this movie is a little bit fresh in that respect.
Although I will say, speaking of 3D, I think the short film that plays before Toy Story 3 is called Day and Night. And I think that is the best use of 3D I've ever seen, because I can't understand. Like, the 3D is part of telling the animated story. I don't see how you could tell this story in 2D.
I was wondering if the fact that it was going to be in 3D might have been the inspiration for the story, because it uses, like, the depth of field in this way that's real ingenious.
To quickly describe that short, it's essentially an encounter between two non-speaking, sort of vaguely human, sort of shmoo-looking characters that are, like, they're hand-drawn. Their outlines are two-dimensional, but within each of their bodies, they express themselves by these visualizations of things that are going on in the landscape around them. So one of them is day, one of them is night, and consequently, you know, the day guy will be, you know, you'll see a girl on a beach, and the night guy will get all excited, and he'll jump
stand
over
in
and
place.
Stay in the same place, and it's an empty deserted beach, and there's, like, an empty soda can or something, and he's upset. And it sounds kind of silly put in those words, but it's actually very clever and really well done. And it's kind of maybe the best kind of callback to, like, some of the fun imagination of even, like, the good Pink Panther short cartoons and things along those lines.
Yeah, it's like the dot and the line and things
like that. Yeah, I mean, these things that are kind of abstract, and it's really refreshing in that respect. It's very well done.
Yeah, and the outlines of the characters are almost like windows. So in 3D, it's like you look through them to see the background.
Exactly, to see the stuff that's going on, yeah.
Well, one thing I was sort of wondering going into the movie was that how it represented as far as, like, Pixar's direction. And, you know, we've just had – the last three movies have been Ratatouille, WALL-E, and Up, none of which kind of fit the Pixar formula up until then, with these, you know, very colorful characters who all kind of look like toys. And there's, like, this ensemble of funny people who banter with each other. And they're all kind of – unlikely, the current three. One's about a rat, one's about a garbage disposing robot, and one's about an old man, you know, mm-hmm. They're not necessarily, you know, they don't listen to action figures necessarily.
Right. None of them really have celebrity voices.
Yeah, that too. So, and I thought the Toy Story might be a step back, but it was like, no, it sort of continues the emotional complexity thing. But I'm wondering if y'all had a sense of, you know, since like Cars 2 is their next film, and I guess we didn't see a trailer for Cars 2, did we?
We won't. Yeah. Cars 2 doesn't come out till summer next year, so I think we'll see one this winter.
Yeah.
So I mean, it feels almost like there's been kind of a, you know, the classic Hollywood equation when trying to balance, you know, doing interesting movies versus movies that have commercial appeal is the old, you know, one for them, one for me sort of thing. And it feels like, you know, the one for me movies kind of bunched up at Pixar.
Yeah.
Again, Ratatouille, Up, WALL-E, and now we're sort of getting, we're paying for those movies. Yeah. Pixar, and not paying for them in a pejorative sense, but just, you know, getting back to like, okay, now we're going to throw out a couple of movies that are pretty guaranteed.
We don't need to have a third act where a character is wandering alone in a post-apocalyptic wasteland. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, we can still make these movies, you know, which would be throwaways from any other studio, and we can still, you know, Pixar can still make them with the attention to emotion and script and you know, sometimes character that they do so well. So it's maybe not a, I don't know if it's a step back, but it's just part of that eternal kind of balancing act in Hollywood where you can only get away with doing odd original movies for so long, and then you eventually have to kind of go back and pay the bills with something like Toy Story 3, which, you know, and the joke being that which of the two was Toy Story 2 or was it Toy Story 3 that was originally envisioned as like a direct-to-video sequel and so, you know,
maybe both of them.
No, Toy Story
was 3 could ever,
no, 3 was always envisioned as a feature film.
So, you know, there was that point where Toy Story 2 was maybe going to be made without Pixar. Disney was just going to do their own thing and whatever. And so some of these sequels coming from Pixar kind of feel like, hey, no, look, we can give you what you want, but we can still do it in a way that is going to not make us feel cheap.
Yeah. And it is odd. It is funny, though, that they were going to do a movie called Newt that involved, like, I think a male and female newt in a lab. And I don't know what, you know, but apparently they've abandoned and are doing, wouldn't say Monsters, Inc. 2 is in place of that, but that is now on their schedule. So it's sort of like,
yeah, Newt is dead.
Yeah. So, and it's like the next film that I'm really looking forward to from them is, I think it's called Brave now.
It was originally called The Bear and the Bow.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to it because I suppose at that point it will be their 13th film. It'll be their first film with a female protagonist, which I think is long overdue. It'll also be their first film directed by a woman, whose name escapes me at the moment.
I think Reese Witherspoon voices the...
Reese Witherspoon.
And it's, I don't know that much about it, but it involves like, it's like a period piece that involves like archery and things like that.
Yeah, I don't know that much about it.
Right, but I'm looking forward to that because, well, Cars just holds no interest for me. I will watch any Pixar film gladly, but the first one just doesn't really do anything for me, and so I don't really want to return to those characters. And Monsters, Inc. 2 could be good, but again, I'm always sort of eager for new material. But as Russ said, just because they're doing a sequel doesn't mean it's automatically going to be bad. Toy Story 2 is amazing.
Yeah. One thing I will say is that I read a description of the plot of Cars 2, and it just sounded terrible. Hopefully it's better than the description made it sound. But there's the short on the Cars DVD called Mater and the Ghost Light is pretty funny. There are other Mater shorts, like these real little ones that are like 2 or 3 minutes, called like Mater's Tall Tales. And they're pretty funny. So it's almost like they have kind of the kind of anarchic Pixar quality that wasn't really in the movie Cars itself that much. So, yeah. So anyway, okay, cool. So perhaps we should move on to Jonah Hex now, and you know, kind of, you feel like, you know, like kicking someone when he's down, right. So, kicking someone when he's down and horribly scarred.
Right.
You know,
right.
So. Talk about Jonah Hex.
God. Okay. Yeah. I'll take point on this one. So Jonah Hex is a Warner Brothers movie based on a DC Comics character that has been around for a while. Essentially, Jonah Hex is this sort of supernatural vengeance cowboy. Mm-hmm. He's like Ghost Rider in a way, which mm-hmm. Ghost Rider being a Marvel comic that became the terrible Nicolas Cage movie a few years back. So Jonah Hex stars Josh Brolin mm-hmm. as the title character.
You guys keep going.
Yeah.
His family is there's a prologue that's a little bit muddled, but basically he's a Confederate soldier, and he turns against his unit because he thinks that what they're doing is wrong, and doing so leads him to kill his best friend Jeb, and
causes them to get killed.
Right.
It's
right.
Kind of vague as to
it is,
whether
yeah,
he kills anyone personally.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Like I said, a little bit muddled in the beginning. But Jeb's father, Quentin Turnbull, played by John Malkovich, takes revenge upon Jonah Hex, basically kills Hex's family, mm-hmm. his wife and kid, and scars him, ties him to a sort of a cross and scars him. And mm-hmm. this whole process leads Jonah Hex to being this kind of half spirit walker sort of guy where yeah. he can commune with the dead a little bit. He can walk up to a dead body and touch it, and it'll come back to life and talk to him. Mm-hmm. And there are some weird rules that are attached to that. And essentially the movie is this big vengeance story where Jonah Hex finds out that Turnbull is still alive. Mm-hmm. Turnbull has assembled this ridiculous sort of wild west sort mm-hmm. of weapon mm-hmm. That he plans to deploy on the 4th of July during America's first centennial against mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. He's going to destroy the country with this big weapon. Mm-hmm. So Hex is out to stop Turnbull, and along the way there's Megan Fox as a bar girl slash
just a
poor.
The big weapon is on a boat.
The big weapon is on a boat, yeah.
It has he wants to take over America, but he's on a boat. And there's like a middle part of America that yeah. the boat won't reach.
Well, his point is basically to destroy the Union.
No, right. I know.
Which I guess he equates with destroying Washington, D.C.
Right. Yeah. So he's going to destroy the government. Turnbull mm-hmm. also being a former Confederate officer.
Yeah.
He's going to destroy Washington, D.C., kill the president. Mm-hmm. We get these scenes of, you know, the incomplete, the shell of like the Lincoln Monument and the Washington Monument is yeah. being built, et cetera. The thing with this movie is that it had some problems mm-hmm. as it was being made. There were rewrites, there were reshoots. Francis Lawrence, the guy who directed I Am Legend mm-hmm. and I, Robot was brought into, or I'm sorry, not I, Robot, I Am Legend was brought in to oversee the reshoots as creative director, i.e. as the new director. And the movie subsequently is, at a certain point, they just decided, okay, we're going to basically cut this movie like a highlight reel. So
yeah,
it's
yeah.
it's 85 minutes long
that,
or something.
Yeah.
It's super short. It's just moves super fast, mm-hmm. but not necessarily breezily mm-hmm. or with any particular,
there's not
know,
a lot of energy
zing
to it.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
action scenes are all right, but I would say most of like the energy and the action of the film, what at least got me, what captivated me was Josh Brolin's performance as Jonah Hex and Michael Fassbender, who is probably best known as playing the British soldier mm-hmm. in Inglourious Basterds. Mm-hmm. And he played
the greatest film critic in movies ever exactly. know, presented, yes.
Right. And so basically, he plays Turnbull's henchman, mm-hmm. and he's a lot of fun.
He's just like this heavily tattooed Irish guy, and so he's yeah. and his charisma kind of comes through, but not a lot. No one else looks that good, unfortunately.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, Brolin. I liked Brolin.
I thought he
Brolin
was okay.
worked for
yeah.
me,
yeah.
you know. And I mean, Brolin is doing the whole almost the entire movie through a pretty significant facial makeup scarring mm-hmm. thing. So he's kind of growling and chewing out his lines, and
yeah.
but he still projects some personality, and he doesn't look completely ridiculous doing it, which surprised me, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Fassbender is certainly the highlight. I mean, he's super entertaining. Mm-hmm. He's got a great natural energy and charisma, and he's a bad guy that you want to see more of. Mm-hmm. And
Megan Fox doesn't bring the movie down, which I
she's not in it enough
yeah,
to bring
yeah.
it down. She's just there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, she's got a – they give her a couple of dialogue scenes that don't really fly. But, yeah, again, she's better than I expected. Yeah.
The film just feels bare bones, and I wanted to see it be – it feels – I believe the film's PG-13, and it feels like it should be a much angrier film, a more – kind of a hard R-rated spaghetti western. Mm. I mean, the opening is essentially the outlaw Josie Wales. I mean, it's kind of the same setup there. And I think they kind of went for that vibe at first, and then it just becomes like generic vengeance story.
One thing that's odd about it, just kind of for that, whether or not it's actually a western, because something to take place in what looks like Death Valley, but most of it, we're told, takes place in like the South, like in Georgia, and
it has an odd Charleston sense of geography.
And they're like, well, how are they riding these hundreds and hundreds of miles on horseback in like a day? Right. You know, so
yeah. Well, I mean, logic and that sort of story continuity isn't the movie's biggest strong suit, and in that respect, it certainly feels like a victim of overzealous editing.
And when there's a lot of narration, which is usually a sign that a film is being tied together.
There's a lot of narration. There are some weird choices. I mean, you've got kind of Hex's origin is told in a certain part of his origin is told kind of straightforward and with the narration. And then it goes into this sort of almost flash animated sequence that really doesn't look very good and doesn't tell the story. That's sort of intended to tell the story of how Hex became sort of a supernatural guy. It doesn't tell that story very well. Later on in the movie, there are these kind of almost like metaphysical fight sequences between Hex and Turnbull where they're like, they're fighting in the real world, but they're also fighting in this sort of hellish Georgia clay.
It's like there's
plane.
This dream scene that appears where they're fighting, and they cut back into
the movie.
Why are we looking at this again? What does it mean?
It doesn't really make. I mean, it's it's weird. The part of me that really loves the B movie and that really loves kind of weirdo westerns and some of the strange European movies from the 70s where these guys would kind of go out on a limb and tell a story that didn't really make a whole lot of sense, but would throw interesting actors into it and really base the whole movie around their personality. That part of me sees something in Jonah Hex and responds to it. And I was entertained on a certain level by a lot of individual things within Hex. There's all sorts of little stuff that feels to me like it could be part of any of these movies that I love. But as a whole, Hex is pretty shambly and just kind of barely held together and just feels like it's tape and wire and spit.
And if you look carefully, you might see a half second of Michael Shannon.
Yeah, it's like one of the shortest like credited screen
him
appearances.
Him and Danny Houston from Clash of the Titans need to go hang out for another half second.
They got to call SAG and get together with... Because literally, I mean, there's this whole sequence in this sort of weird carnival slash pit fighting.
It's like the pit fighting scene from Sherlock Holmes.
Exactly.
Basically.
Yeah, with a weird demon sort of guy. Yeah. And that's the thing. There was a point in the movie. There was a point where I think there was supposed to be more supernatural stuff in the movie than there is. And actually, one of the best scenes in the movie is a supernatural thing where Hex is talking to his dead best friend, and they have this great little communion, and it's like. It's the scene that kind of recalls the climactic fight sequence in Pirates of the Caribbean between Johnny Depp and Jeffrey Rush, where they're jumping, where they're both zombied and they're jumping in and out of the moonlight that shows them as real people versus zombies. Mm-hmm. And so there's this sequence in Hex that sort of recalls that, and it's good, and it's got some energy and some life, and it feels kind of fun. And if the whole movie was like that, it'd be fantastic.
The more outlandish it gets, the better it gets. Unfortunately, it's pretty restrained.
It's funny you mentioned that because kind of what I hope for Jonah Hex came kind of from when Jonah Hex had an appearance on the Justice League Unlimited show. It was just the animated series, which from about 10 years ago. And there's and I'll just describe it briefly. There's an episode where some of the characters encounter a time traveler and get sent back to the Wild West. And the time traveler's machines, like, fall in the hands of this, like, outlaw boss character. So he starts, like, using weapons from the future and the past to, like, take over this town. And the Justice League team up with all of, like, DC's Western characters, including Jonah Hex, who I believe is voiced by Adam Baldwin on this. And the big final fight scene has got everything. It's got like robots with six shooters and gunslingers riding dinosaurs, you know. And there were some of the Jonah Hex comic books. He went to this post-apocalyptic future where there are like robots and mutants and things like that. And it's like, I wanted something more like that.
Yeah, but see, you just described the opening sequence in Toy Story 3.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
that's where you go. That's why you liked that so much. Because that's what that whole sequence is.
Sure. You know? Yeah, I will acknowledge that. But there's a part in the movie where they allude to hearing hellhounds. And it was like, early on, it's like, oh, I hope we see these hellhounds. It's like,
and then,
nope.
There's a dog.
Yeah.
And the dog is cute.
Yeah. The thing with the hellhounds is like pulled. I mean, I don't know. It reminded me of Supernatural. There's hellhounds in that, and you hear them, but you don't see them. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just a consequence of Supernatural is a TV show.
Yeah,
but it's the film was made rather cheaply. And I think when you see it, it looks more expensive than it cost, which I think is a good sign. But at the same time, there were budget limitations and sort of like, maybe we can't create 3D hellhounds to drag someone apart.
Right.
They're just going to have to turn to dust.
And I mean, it's kind of weird. There's stuff that, I mean, as far as I understand, it was shot on film, but some of it looks like really, really glaringly average digital video HD stuff. These shots, whenever the movie goes to like something that's taking place in the afternoon, you see like these daylight shots of Jonah Hex riding across the plane, and it just looks choppy and bad. And I don't know if it was our projection or if it was the print or the source image, whatever. But some of the movie looks kind of really ugly and cheap and weird, and then some of it really looks pretty good. And like you said, does have a sense of scale. But there are just weird choices. We were talking earlier about how Malkovich's character assembles this super weapon, which is basically kind of the dumbest cannon ever.
Yeah.
You know, it's this
made by Eli Whitney.
It's this Eli Whitney invented kind of machine gun cannon where it can fire off this huge volley of explosive cannonballs, but then
we'll ignite them until it shoots this you have little
to, yeah, you have to fire this other thing. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You have to use the magic orb.
Pretty much. You have to catch whatever the snitch or whatever it is.
Better. It's like the golden snitch.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of ridiculous, but when they're finally going to assault Washington, D.C. with this cannon that's mounted on a boat, you see the guy firing the cannon, and he's got like this kind of almost plexiglass sight that he's looking through, and it actually has the shape of the Capitol building drawn on it. And it just reminded me of United 93, where the terrorists are trying to fly the plane into the Capitol building, and they have a picture of it taped to the thing. And I was like, really? Is this really what you want to be reminded
me
of here?
That in like his Civil War days, that John Malkovich's character was described as a terrorista.
Exactly.
So, you know, I mean, it seems like that's probably going for that,
But I mean, the whole audience laughed when they saw you know, the outline of the Capitol building as the aiming site, the reticle for this silly cannon. So yeah, I mean, there's places where there's just these odd choices, and I can't figure out if they thought that their blend of comedy and action and weird supernatural stuff was going to turn out better than it did, or if they just figured, we know it's not going to work, so screw it. Let's throw in a couple of ridiculous ideas like this, and then we'll cut back to Michael Fassbender, and everything will be fine because he's charismatic enough to save a scene. Okay, so we're at the halfway point of the summer, and the interesting thing is that the returns have been pretty poor. You know, both creatively speaking, movies this summer have been, I mean, they're summer movies, we don't expect a lot, but even set against that relatively undemanding scale, the stuff that we've seen so far this year has been pretty unimpressive. There's not much memorable stuff coming out. And people seem to be kind of responding in kind. Box office is down, attendance is down. And when box office is down, even when you've got inflated 3D ticket prices, and I think ticket prices are up 8% on average from a year ago, which is a gigantic jump.
Yeah.
And it's a very poor jump because of the recession.
Right, exactly.
Movies were doing, I mean, sorry, not to cut in, but last year movies revenue was up because people can't go on vacations, but they, you know, they can't go to Disneyland, but they want to take their family out. So
right. I'm having my staycation at Regal 24.
Right, yeah, right.
This year.
But no, it was an affordable means, and now you have movies, the price goes up, and at some point it's like, sorry, I can't pay $50 to...
Or I can, but I'm not going to because right. I'm going to see Jonah Hex or I'm going to see, you know, whatever.
And it's becoming less compelling to go out when the release window between a theater and the home video release is so short. Just wait 4 months, go to a red box, pay a dollar, and now you get to see the movie. Hooray!
Exactly. And, you know, there's word that earlier this week there were a couple of articles written that were saying that supposedly studio heads are calling the agencies and being like, we need original stuff.
Yeah.
We need, you know, so our reliance on rebooting TV shows and all of this sort of thing, making sequels.
The pre-awareness of strategy isn't working like we hoped. You know?
Exactly. So what can we do differently? And I don't know if that's going to work. I don't know if 2 years from now, suddenly we're going to see, you know, these original movies that are actually good. I kind of doubt it. You know, we've still been blaming the writer's strike for some of the fallout of the crappy movies that we've had. But the simple truth just seems to be that very few execs in Hollywood at studios seem to have any balls and seem to be willing to come up with an idea and commit to it and make it that way. I mean, you know, Clash of the Titans, Warner Brothers has obviously got some stuff going on because Clash of the Titans underwent a huge number of changes. Jonah Hex underwent changes. Other movies maybe haven't had the same problem, but they've had these protracted, weird development periods like the A-Team or whatever. And you just get these things that don't have a whole lot of personality and they're loud and boring and derivative.
It's weird because other films, and I think studios are also being cautious because of the recession. Some studios just kind of want to stay in the $40 million range. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't really jack up this price very much. Mm-hmm. So let's try to keep it contained because if it's an original idea. But for instance, Paramount didn't really want to take chances. Was Paramount Anchorman and Zoolander?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those basically sequels were offered for both, and they kind of, you know, got into development a little bit. It started sparking, and Paramount said no to both. And I kind of understand where they're coming from because they're both cult hit movies. Neither one did super well in theaters.
Well, Anchorman did pretty well. It
did relatively well. Yeah. Well, you know, some of the problem was supposedly budget.
You know,
they wanted to make those who were trying to make Anchorman 2 wanted to make it for, you know, like 80 or 90 million, and Paramount was like, eh, let's bring it down to
40.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe it was 60 that they wanted to spend on it, and Paramount would only spend 40. And I kind of, you know, I get that. It's like, you should be able to make, if you know,
how
if
much
Moon
how
can
much
be,
CGI do you need to muse on Anchorman 2?
Or more to the point, you know, if Duncan Jones can make Moon for $5 million, you know, granted it's only got, you know, a couple of actors in it, but still, you know, there's effects, there's all this stuff, and it's an imaginative movie, and he made it for $5 million. You know, you can make these movies. Splice is a cheap movie, and doesn't look like a cheap movie. You know, it can still be done. You can still make a good movie for under $50 million. But there's just so much, you know, and I don't know if it's when you're doing Anchorman 2 that, you know, again, you've got a huge pool of talent that you have to pay. But even if they cut their things, you know, you've got additional development overhead at the studio. You've got all these costs that you're taking into account before you even start shooting a movie.
Right. Will Ferrell, Paul Rudd, and Steve Carell are all much bigger stars than they were in 2003 or 2004 when the film came out. So, but again, even if they took, you know, cuts, it's studios are being very cautious these days. And when you look at these box office returns, it's not difficult to see why.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's just not that much. There's not that much reason to go see a lot of these movies. Even, you know, something like The A-Team, which I kind of enjoyed.
Yeah.
I wouldn't really recommend people to rush out to see it because it's not that good. It's okay.
Yeah.
But it's better than bad.
Yeah, it's like we it was like better than we expected, but we had to see it in effect. So
the calculus is
a little different, you know. Okay, yeah.
I liked it.
Yeah, well, I liked it too. You know, I recommended it, and it's kind of marginal. Right. If you want to see a movie that's like a real MacGruber, you know, see it, you know. So
right, and see that's the thing. You know, you have a movie like MacGruber that I think, with better marketing and timing, mm-hmm. could have been a nice little hit. You know, not like a huge blockbuster, but that movie totally tanked. And mm-hmm. so there's also something to be said about, you know, a studio can make the investment, but if you don't follow through on it mm-hmm. correctly, then you're kind of just throwing money away.
Yeah, well, yeah.
That's what studios do. Yeah. But, you know, I think Fox Searchlight has an amazing marketing team when it comes to their Oscar films. I mean, mm-hmm. they make hits out of Slumdog Millionaire and Little Miss Sunshine and Juno, and they're just very good at what they do. So I think that, you know, with a smart marketing team, you can take smaller pictures and really do something with them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Studios can make better movies by just making better decisions and sticking to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, why did Universal pay out like $6.5 million for scripts for Robin Hood, mm-hmm. you know?
I mean,
it's like there were so many drafts of that movie mm-hmm. that, you know, before the movie even rolled, they'd mm-hmm. spent almost $7 million just on the script, mm-hmm. which sucked, mm-hmm. you know? And it's that sort of thinking and that sort of creative indecision.
Mm-hmm. Well, with Robin Hood too, it's like, I mean, I don't remember how much we talked about Robin Hood much when it came out, but it was like, it was going to be about the Sheriff of Nottingham, you know, and called Nottingham. And then it was, you know, there was talk that Russell Crowe would play both the sheriff and Robin Hood. And so clearly they had all these ideas to, like, do this different kind of Robin Hood movie. And then it's like, no, let's just make the same old kind of Robin Hood movie.
Right. Well, it turned out that when Ridley Scott came on board, he's like, I want to make a movie about archery. Like, that was his fascination. And so
I know Ridley Scott sounded so much like George Lucas.
He really does. If you have a beard, that's what you sound like.
Yeah, it muffles
in Hollywood.
The actual voice.
You sound like a Muppet.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, but we'll like hoping for an Inception, I guess, is like maybe the next big hit movie that'll be
July 16th.
Yeah. So. I mean, Inception and Scott Pilgrim are the only two studio pictures that I have any hope for.
Right. And I mean, but there are indies coming out that I'm looking forward to. Cyrus. I'm looking forward to The Killer Inside Me.
Yeah.
I think the best film I've seen this summer is Exit Through the Gift Shop. Mm-hmm. So
I mean, Exit Through the Gift Shop is the best movie of the year, mm-hmm. period, I think. I don't think there's anything that's even come close to that. And if there is, if anything comes close to it later this year, I'll be thrilled, because mm-hmm. that means that we'll have two incredible movies. Well, I mean, you know.
Actually, I do. I have one that is one that I liked. It's in my top three of the year to date, which is Please Give. Yes. Mm-hmm. Nicole Holofcener, is that it? And it's like this wonderful comedy of manners with Catherine Keener, Oliver Platt. I won't go into a whole review of it, but it's this really neat story that's very well observed, funny, low-key but very charming and warm and all that. And it's like, we just deserve more films like this that obviously aren't that expensive, you know. It's mm-hmm. like, I mean, and they probably can earn their money back without too much trouble, so it's mm-hmm. like, why don't – it seems like it would be a good business model to make more movies like it. You know?
Right, yeah. Right. And, you know, there's other stuff that's mm-hmm. around that's still playing. You know, this weekend I finally caught up with – you know, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Mm-hmm. Not a great movie, mm-hmm. but a better movie than most of the studio stuff that's mm-hmm. been out. And if you like, you know, thrillers and, you know, are into sort of the concept of this kind of weird, like almost locked room mystery, mm-hmm. and are willing to deal with a little bit of kind of horrifying, violent content, it's, mm-hmm. you know, certainly a more satisfying movie than I think any of the big studios have put out this year, whatever my qualms about it are. And, you know, I saw Greenberg. Greenberg mm-hmm. is a lot more challenging, but I was still, you know, entertained by it and kind of captured by it in a way that a lot of other stuff hasn't done. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of options out there. They're just not the ones that are $100 million movies.
Wind up with our video picks, stuff for further viewing, basically.
Okay. I'll kick it off. I recently saw this great short documentary called I Knew It Was You, which is about the actor John Cazale. And a lot of people don't know who that is. They know, but when you show a photo of him, people say, oh, that's Fredo from mm-hmm. The Godfather. And that's what he's best known for. But he also appeared he also was in The Conversation and The Deer Hunter and Dog Day Afternoon. And he...
That might be his filmography, those...
Pretty much.
The two Godfather films and the
others. Five amazing films. But he, unfortunately, he died very young. He died of cancer. And the film is fascinating, partially because of, you know, Cazal's story. But the thing that really I found intriguing was the film is about other actors, some who worked with him and some who didn't. But they're talking about his skill as an actor. And I find that really interesting when actors talk about the art of acting. And not just sort of an inside the actor's studio kind of way where it's like, what was – I can't do my James Lipton impression. but you know, it's – you know, what is your favorite color? And it's like, oh, obviously. But, you know, so you have people like Sam Rockwell and Philip Seymour Hoffman and Al Pacino. And they're talking about how working – how Cazal sort of – he had this tendency to make the people around him better. He wasn't a show stealer, but he had the skill to be. Mm-hmm. And he also had the courage to play weakness, which a lot of actors don't. They don't want to appear that fragile. And he was absolutely willing to do that, but not necessarily in ways you would expect. And so I would recommend it. It's only about 40 minutes long, but it's a really interesting flick.
I'd actually jump in on I Knew It Was You, which I was lucky enough to see in a theater last year at a festival, and
I caught it on HBO.
It's an HBO doc, and I think that most people, unless you caught it at one of a couple of small festivals, the only real chance to see it is on HBO, which is fine. One of the things about I Knew It Was You is that Cazal was in a relationship with Meryl Streep when he died, and she has never talked about him publicly until this film, and she speaks about him both kind of with eloquence and passion and this great sensitivity, and just seeing her talk about who he was as a person and who he was as an actor is incredibly powerful, because you get a lot of stuff from her that really nobody has heard before that doesn't know these people personally. And it's kind of a big thing for the film to actually have her on camera talking about him. And and that makes it an even more powerful film than it might have already been. And yeah, absolutely recommend it. Fantastic stuff.
Okay. I'm going to try and squeeze three recommendations in a short period of time, but inspired by Jonah Hex, which is a Western, I thought I'd recommend some actual, which Jonah Hex may or may not be a Western because it might be a quote-unquote Southern. But,
he wears a cowboy hat.
Yeah,
it's a Western.
but I thought I'd recommend three like actual classic Westerns for people who like believe the genre as itself. You know, one is Red River, Howard Hawks' film, which is kind of like Mutiny on the Bounty re-envisioned on a cattle drive with John Wayne and the Captain Bly equivalent character, I believe Montgomery Clift as the Fletcher Christian. You know, snappy dialogue, but a great kind of rolling landscapes kind of movies. Kind of weird, oddly funny ending, but it's still, you know, a great one. Another is Ride the High Country, which is not as famous as a lot of them, but
awesome
movie. Yeah, which is a wonderful, wonderful kind
early
of underappreciated.
Sam Peckinpah.
Kind of before Sam Peckinpah really pushed his stylishness that far, but you see glimmers of it, and it's very well done too. I think it's Randolph Scott and Joel McRae.
Yeah, young Warren Oates in a small role.
Yeah, and I think Mariette Hartley is the girl in that, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which is a little bit different, which is Robert Altman bringing his kind of overlapping dialogue naturalism to a Western story, which is very much similar to HBO's Deadwood, if you watch that. Mm-hmm. I think Deadwood was very influenced by it with Warren Beatty and Julie Christie as kind of a gambling man and a prostitute who sort of start this mining town's like kind of vice community, and the town kind of builds up around them. And it's very kind of cold and snowy. It doesn't feel like a usual Western, but it's a really neat movie, and it really kind of will have a hold on you that will really linger after you see it.
And one more Western, and to go back to Peckinpah, is one of my favorite movies of his is The Ballad of Cable Hogue, which is this really underseen Western with Jason Robards as this guy who is sort of working with these couple of other guys, and they leave him for dead in the desert, and he is essentially crawling around in the desert begging God for his life because he has no water and he's afraid he's going to die, and he basically makes this pact with God and finds water and subsequently sets up this spring basically having a business selling water to people who are on the midpoint of this long road between a couple of towns. And he sets up business there and kind of essentially waits to try to find his former compatriots again so that he can have his revenge. But in the meantime, he falls in love, and there's also this whole thing about kind of the encroachment of civilization mm-hmm. onto the West, because you start to see automobiles coming in and things like that. And it's this really, you know, from Peckinpah, who after Ride the High Country became mm-hmm. sort of noted for his violent movies mm-hmm. like The Wild Bunch and Straw Dogs. Mm-hmm. Ballad of Cable Hogue is much more sensitive mm-hmm. and kind of funnier and a little bit weirder, mm-hmm. and the performances are a little quirkier, but it's a really neat sort of mm-hmm. Vengeance movie / End of the West story, yeah. and really, really great stuff.
I haven't seen that. Now I'm interested in it. So mm-hmm. cool.
And it's also a big influence on for the gamers out there. It's a relatively big influence on Red Dead Redemption,
which is there
the big,
you go.
The big yeah. Western video game that's out right now. Yeah. Definitely has echoes of Ballad of Cable Hogue.
Okay, cool. So, well, once again, this has been Running Dialogue, a podcast about movies. And my name is Kurt Holman, and I tweet at Kurt_Holman at Twitter, whatever you call it. Kurt_Holman Twitter, that's where I tweet at.
I'm Matt Goldberg. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Matt Goldberg, all one word.
And I'm Russ Fisher. I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/RussFisher, FISCHER, all one word.
And thanks for listening.